This is a CBC podcast.
Hey, I'm Tom Power, and welcome to the Q interview from CBC Podcast and from Q on CBC Radio 1. Welcome to the show. Thanks so much for streaming or downloading or however you get this. If you're listening to this podcast wondering where the pride and joy of Regina, Saskatchewan, Caitlin Swan is, who's normally here, our producer who is normally here to read listener mail, she's off sick right now. She's got a cold. It's not COVID, but she's got a bit of a cold. She's actually on the prompter right now talking to me from home. Hi, Caitlin. I'll read what she writes to me. Hi, Caitlin. She says, hello. It's me. I'm dying. So obviously Caitlin's feeling a lot better. She said, send help. I think by help, she means Gatorade. Anyway, first off, she says drugs. So if you have any like Neocitrin, I'm pretty sure what she means. If you have any Neocitrin, please send it her way. First off, I want to say right off the bat that Buffy St. Marie, our guest today, is in her 80s. I don't say that because I want to lead with her age or anything like that, nor do I think she'd mind if I led with her age. But the reason I do it is because she has lived a life. And listen, I don't want to give away too much about our conversation because it's sort of the way the story unfolds that I found really compelling. Her childhood, her teenage years, connecting with her Indigenous family, the early days of the folk scene, helping getting Joni Mitchell a record deal. Listen, if I go on and on about what she talked about, we'd have no more time left for the actual interview. But I'll tell you that Buffy St. Marie is with us because she is the subject of a new podcast series from CBC Podcasts. It's called Buffy. And she's also just released a new children's book called Tapue and the Magic Hat. Here is my conversation with the living legend herself, Buffy St. Marie. Buffy St. Marie. Hi.
Tom.
How are you doing?
I'm trying to survive the trip here, but I'm okay. I'm
you know
glad
what?
To be here.
As long, you know, you never have to leave if you don't want.
Oh, thank
I
you.
I can put a cot over there and a kettle and a garden. It'll be grand. I was thinking about you putting out a children's book, which we're going to talk a little bit about later. When did music enter your life when you were a kid? When did you first get interested in music?
Oh, first time I saw a piano.
Yeah.
I was probably about 3. And I went over and went plink, plink, and that did it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I just, it was the funnest tool I had. I was a, you know, crayons and paper and dance and sing and just like most children are when they're about 4 years old and go to the beach, you know, they do everything. Children are creative.
Yeah.
I think it's schools who start to tell you, oh, you have to do just one thing. If you're a musician, you can't be an artist and blah, blah, blah. But I had a hard time in school in that I was told I couldn't be a musician because I couldn't read European notation. Turned
right.
out I was dyslexic in music.
Yeah.
So they wouldn't let me in band or anything, but I'd go home and I'd play the heck out of that piano.
What were you playing? What were you playing on the piano?
Anything I would hear on the radio, or we had a record player and I liked Tchaikovsky, like Swan Lake, the Nutcracker Suite.
Okay, so you weren't playing
Wagner.
Rock and roll or anything like that. You're playing classical music.
No, there wasn't any rock and roll yet. This is the 40s.
Ah,
so
yeah.
When I was about 12 or 13, along comes Little Richard, right? And Chuck Berry and Fats Domino. And by the time I was 15, I started going to the Alan Freed rock and roll shows. And I knew that's what I wanted to do. I knew I already had the music. I just didn't know what to do with it. But when I saw Joanne Campbell come out on a stage, right, she had that Southern girl attitude, and she was wearing a sparkly, long, sexy dress with a train and singing the heck out of this great Southern rock and roll. You know, and there was Laverne Baker. There were the Everly Brothers.
I love that.
Was Elvis Presley, who was just my hero when he was 19. I mean, that's just what I thought I would like to do. So I was lucky.
Let's go back a little bit. So I want to talk about where you were born, and I want to do it through this song. Take a listen to this. That's Coppell Valley, Saskatchewan, off your 1976 album, Sweet America.
Can I tell you something about it?
Yeah, of course.
When I first tried to play it for another musician, my drummer always referred, he couldn't say Coppell Valley, Saskatchewan, right? He'd always say, that song that sounds like a three-legged horse, because it's... Right, is trying to do a round dance beat, which he had never heard before.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
And so you were born in Saskatchewan near Paiapod First Nation.
We think.
Yeah, we think. Not long after that, you're in Massachusetts.
And Maine.
How old?
Baby.
Like months?
I don't know. Infant, though.
Sent you brought there, brought to.
I guess.
Yeah,
I mean, they don't tell you. You have to understand what it's like to be an Indigenous person who has been adopted.
Yeah.
The records are sealed. You don't get to find out anything.
Yeah.
I mean, in the 40s, because it was, you know, we must protect everybody's privacy, or, yeah. You know, and why were they adopting and what is it, you know, so I don't know a lot. And that's one of the, it's not a terrible thing. It's not like residential schools.
No.
But it is, it's another part of the story of breaking the generations in the Indigenous world, you know, kidnapping children and giving them away, selling them, rehoming them.
Not a lot of other Indigenous people growing up in Massachusetts and Maine in your community, I would say.
Well, not that anybody knew of.
Yeah.
Of course, there were Indigenous people in Maine, but the white people didn't know about it, or they didn't say anything about it.
But I mean
it.
For you, for your friends and your community when you were growing up.
No. The only other Indigenous person where I was growing up was a wonderful man and his wife who ran a trading post, and he was Narragansett.
Yeah.
And so he really was the first you know, just pure Indigenous person that I had ever met. And he was kind of like a grown-up friend to me when I was a child. I'd go over to the trading post every now and then. I'd ride my bike around the lake and go and visit them. And they were always nice to me. And he used to make headdresses for the movies.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. Oh, he was wonderful. Yeah.
What was his name?
Leonard Baird. He was Narragansett. And and my mom, who raised me, was part Mi'kmaq, right?
Yeah.
And but she didn't know anything about it. And he was kind of in the same boat because nobody knew anything about Narragansetts either. So
when did you go back to Saskatchewan? You went back when you were a teenager, right?
Yeah, I guess I was 18 or 19.
Why?
Why?
Yeah.
Oh, I was invited.
Oh, yeah.
I had met the Paiapods at Wikwimacon. I had met Emil Paiapod and John Rock Thunder and Henry Ironchild, a whole lot of Crees who were in a, I don't know, elder's circle sounds really stuffy and formal, but actually they just said, you know, we're going to go and have a meeting. I'm going to have a meeting with the old men. And so there were societies back in those days, societies of friends. And these particular people traveled around to powwows, and they were at Wikwimacon. And Emil Paiapod and Clara Starblanket Paiapod had lost two children, two daughters, and had three other children. And there's a tradition in many Indigenous groups that if you lose a child, that you keep your hearts open for someone to fill that spot. And they thought that I probably needed to fill that spot. And
yeah.
So they adopted me. And I can just hear the listeners envisioning an adoption ceremony and, you know, kind of like they do when the prime minister comes to town and they give him a feather hat and a name. But it wasn't like that at all.
No, you just went out.
It was just very, they just did.
You know, the Cree author, you know, David A. Robertson, great, great author, and also does children's books and does a lot of great work. He talks a little bit about blood memory, like a sense of home for somewhere he hadn't been before.
Mm.
Did you get any of that when you went back to Saskatchewan?
Well, yeah, but I don't know if it was connected with what we would call reality.
Yeah.
I certainly felt like it.
That's what I'm asking.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not asking anything literal here. Did you feel something special when you went there?
I just felt welcome.
Yeah.
I felt safe, probably for the first time in my life. Because I was raised in a house in a neighborhood where there were predators all over the place.
Oh.
And so I felt safe. I had new sisters, my sister Brenda, my sister Cara, my brothers Ronnie and Alvin. They became my family. And, it wasn't like in the press.
No.
I didn't tell anybody for years anything about that. I got busted. I think it was the Toronto Star who busted us. It was a winter day, and I'm sitting in the cabin with the Paiapods. You know, we're just sitting around. I don't know what we were doing. And there's a knock on the door, and it's snowy. It's awful, right? And there's this guy from Toronto newspaper who wants to interview me. Of course, I wanted to hide under the table.
Were you were you famous at this point? Were you
in
Buffy's?
Toronto, I was, but
yeah.
Not in Saskatchewan.
Yeah.
Yeah, in
so
Toronto.
He went and found you.
He found me. I don't know how. And he did a big Sunday supplement, you know, those giant Sunday supplements they used to have. He did like a 3-page story on me and family and stuff. But yeah, I didn't want to let him in. But my dad, who was so nice, he said, oh, come in, come in. Because that's how he is, right? It's just hospitality.
Yeah.
So that's when people found out about my connection with the Pequots. But up until then, it had been totally private.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I ask? I've always wanted to ask you this.
Uh-oh.
You were in New York in Greenwich Village, mm-hmm. in the sort of coffee house era, mm-hmm. the early 1960s. Mm-hmm. Dylan.
And you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. Or the times they are a-changing.
The Clancy Brothers and Tommy Makem.
Captain, make your ready quick and soon. For the Pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon.
Dave Van Ronk, Joni Mitchell, Ian and Sylvia. To me, like, I have such an affection for that time. Mm-hmm. I've often, sometimes, you know, people will ask you, if you could live in any other time, what would it be? And mind you, I love living in this time right now, but if you could live in any other time, what would it be? I always say that.
Era. That would be your choice,
yeah.
Huh?
What was that actually like back then?
I loved it, too.
Yeah?
I loved it, too. Now, I wasn't a part of the social group, which is basically a business group, right? Like the Peter Pan, Mary, Bob, Dylan, Joan, you know, they all had managers. Who were,
yeah, they all had the same manager.
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah, what was his name?
Albert Grossman.
Albert Grossman, yeah.
And Manny Greenhill and Harold mm-hmm. Leventhal. They kind of controlled the business.
Yeah.
And if you weren't part of their stable, that's what they called it. If you weren't part of their stable, then you were kind of out of it. I mean, that didn't bother me because I'm such a hermit anyway. You know, I don't drink. So after the show, I don't go out.
Yeah.
And you know, party and celebrate and stuff. I don't know. I just don't care for it. So I stay in. So there was a lot of both social and business networking that I did not do. So I don't really consider myself a part of the social or business scene like that. But I was there. And, you know, I knew Bob and, you know, I knew Dave a little. I don't think he liked me. Bob did, though. Yeah.
Bob liked you?
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, I saw him a few years ago in Australia, in this big festival that we were doing.
Oh,
Byron Bay Festival.
Yeah, I know that festival.
Yeah, and he wanted to see me. So we set it up, and we got to talk between a whole bunch of big trailers, you know, big old equipment trailers. It was fun.
Would you talk about the old days?
Oh, not very much. You know, no, well, I started... I did not, he said. And I said, yes, you did not. I did not. It was fun. I like him a lot. I still think he's the best of all of us.
He's incredible.
He's wonderful. He's still wonderful. I've always loved him. I think he's fantastic.
Did you see him in a coffee shop? Did you see him play in a coffee shop and all that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, he was all over the place. Anybody could see him. It was good.
And Joni was there?
I didn't see Joni in the village at all. I knew Joni early. And when I first heard Joni, I thought she was just the best.
Woke up, it was a Chelsea morning, and the first thing that I heard was a song outside my window, and the traffic...
I thought she was wonderful.
Yeah.
It was before Joni had discovered tunings, so I was already using a lot of tunings.
Weird,
right?
I should say for people listening, like, the guitar is typically tuned in one way, what mm-hmm. we call standard tuning, and mm-hmm. you were a pioneer of this, and Joni did a lot of this, too.
She did a little later, yeah.
Yeah.
But the people who were really pioneers in that were black people from the Delta South, American South.
Yeah, Reverend Gary Davis.
Yeah,
had a big to do
yeah.
With that,
but
yeah.
There's no rule as to how you tune an instrument, no. You know, it's a thing, and you're in charge, and I used to tune my guitar. I used to put different kinds of strings on it. Sometimes I use banjo strings. You can put cello strings. I mean, you can be very creative with a guitar if you can get beyond, you know, what your music teacher teaches you as standard.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a world out there.
So what's the story that I mean, you and I have talked a bunch of times and I don't know this story, that you helped Joni out? You helped Joni kind of get into the industry, is that right?
Well, I thought she was so good and she couldn't get arrested. Nobody wanted to know about her, so she gave me a tape. I think it was at the Mariposa Folk Festival. She came to see me, and she gave me a tape. I think it was there. And I carried it around in my purse, and I played it for managers and agents. I played it for my record company. Nobody wanted to know. No, we're interested in you. We don't care about your friend from Saskatchewan, right? And finally, I was at Chart Off Winkler, which is a big agency. And the guy who was my agent, he didn't want to hear Joni either.
Yeah.
But a junior agent named Elliot Roberts.
Wow.
He said, I'll go down and see your friend. And of course, he and Joni made a great career together.
I mean, and ends up making Neil Young's career too.
Yep. And I never saw much of Joni after that until recently. I went to visit Joni at her home. You know, she had a stroke, so she's in a wheelchair. But it was so wonderful to see her. And we had some fun. We had some laughs.
How is she?
You
can tell me after if you want, but she's okay.
She's hanging in there. God, no, her health is, it's problematical.
Yeah.
But she's dealing with it. God bless her. She still steps out, you know. And what was loveliest about our visit, besides just the conversations that we had, was to see her artwork in her house and her paintings. If you love Joni as a musician, then if you actually see her paintings, you'll love it even more. It's beautiful.
Here's something else I'm curious about. So back in those days, there were, you know, we'll get a bit closer to like 64, 65. There's people are singing more and more, early 60s too, more and more anti-war songs, civil rights songs too. And God knows you did your share of that, you know, one of your most successful songs. But you were on stage back then singing about indigenous rights. You were on stage back then singing about genocide. How'd that go over?
It's interesting, you know. Imagine me on a stage at the Gaslight Cafe, a little basement coffee house, you know, kind of like the same kind of thing you could see in Yorkville.
Yeah.
You know, kind of like the Purple Onion, you know, small stage. And the audience would sit there, you know, I'd sing Now That the Buffalo's Gone.
Oh, it's written in books and in songs that we've been mistreated and wronged.
Or a little bit later, My Country, 'Tis of Thy People, You're Dying.
All the tricked and evicted, they know what I mean. My country, 'tis of thy people, you're dying.
Which really is just a list of facts. And the audience would just sit there, and some who'd heard it before or who already knew where I was coming from, they would just love it. But many people were just shocked. The audience would be college students, high school students, young people, and some, you know, once folk music kind of started, you know, being a high profile, there would be there'd be straight older people from a previous generation coming down too. And the attitude really was, the little Indian girl must be mistaken. Yes. So that has kind of been the reaction that I've been living with my entire career.
Mistaken as in that stuff didn't happen.
Oh, she's got to be elaborating. That's got to be exaggeration. It can't really. No, they didn't really do that at residential schools. So I think I was the first person to use the word genocide with regard to the North American Holocaust, which, by the way, goes all the way through Central and South America.
Yeah.
It is all one thing.
Yeah. How do you keep going when people are saying, oh, she must be mistaken?
I know better. I just laugh them off. Okay. I'm a teacher, so I don't scold somebody for not knowing. You don't scold people who are ignorant. You give them something. You teach them.
I know, but you get back up on stage over and over again back then. That's what strikes me, you know?
Well, I don't know. You know, it's like Sesame Street taught me. They said, there's always a new crop of five-year-olds. So you can't get tired of delivering your message because it's always to new people.
We're going to talk about Sesame Street in a second. First, I want to talk to you about this. Take a listen to this.
Well, I went to see my Cindy standing by the door, shoes and stockings in her hand, little bare feet on the floor.
Get along,
Cindy, get along home.
Who is that?
You.
I don't know who that is.
Pete Seeger. Play a little bit longer. Have you ever not seen this video? I'll show it to you afterwards. It's one of my favorite videos of you.
Is it on YouTube?
Yeah.
Ah, look for it.
It's you and Pete Seeger, who, if you're listening to this, my guest is Buffy St. Marie, the Pete Seeger, the godfather of the folk revival, who at that point was blacklisted by the House Un-American Activities Committee for communist groups. He gets a show called Rainbow Quest on public television. He brings you on. You're playing the mouthbow there, singing Cindy Cindy, which is a great old song.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what I'm curious about that. Pete lived a very unique existence there, that he got blacklisted and he wasn't allowed to perform and his songs were banned from television and songs were banned from the radio. It's unique, except that you lived it too.
I did.
Did you ever talk to him about it?
I did, but this might throw you around a corner because I love Pete and you love Pete. However, I had to go through the following process. I was doing a show with Pete and was it Oscar Brand as well?
Yeah.
Anyway, there were a whole lot of artists, maybe Tom Paxton, Judy Collins, you know, contemporary artists. And at the end of the show, we were supposed to come out on the stage and hold hands and sing, "This land is your land. This land is my land." What? You're asking me to sing that? "This land is your land. This land used to be my land." And Pete insisted that I do it. And so I stood on the stage and I wasn't singing. I just wanted to cry. I felt so bullied. And so years later, I mentioned that to Pete and he acknowledged it. You know, he didn't at the time because he just thought that this, I mean, Woody Guthrie is God. This land is your land. This land is my land. So the nicest person in the world, Pete Seeger, is uninformed about Indians.
The most benevolent, seemingly benevolent, you know, fighting for the little man person in the entire world.
Exactly.
Even he doesn't have that knowledge.
Exactly.
He doesn't think to do that.
Yes, and that's a way to put it, too. He didn't have that knowledge. But I'm a teacher, so I can give that knowledge. So that's a blank that I can fill in.
More of my conversation with the legendary Buffy St. Marie after this. Hope you enjoyed what they never tell me what the podcast ads are for. A mattress, another podcast. I think it's often another podcast. Sometimes it's a song. Hope whatever it is, it's good. Here's more of my conversation with Buffy St. Marie. What was the experience like of being blacklisted?
Oh, I didn't know about it.
You must have noticed.
No, I didn't know. It never occurred to me when I finally found out that, you know, when somebody told me that I'd been blacklisted, I called my lawyer. I mean, not at first, but I thought about it. So I was talking to my lawyer and I said, you know, this guy said that he had a letter on White House stationery commending him for having suppressed my music, which deserved to be suppressed or something along those lines. And he said, well, we'll get your FBI files. And I said, I don't have FBI files. Are you kidding? I miss Goody Two-Shoes, you know. I don't smoke pot in the White House lawn. I don't throw rocks through the Bureau of Indian Affairs. You know, I'm not that kind of activist. I'm different. All I am is a girl with a guitar.
Yeah.
And so the FBI said, yeah, we have files on her. Send her to Washington and she can read them. And my lawyer said, no, you guys may come to my office and she will read them in my office. So that's what we did. And sure enough, there were FBI files on me, that pages. And all they showed was that I was not guilty of anything. But there was also a letter in those files from some woman who'd wanted to know about this St. Marie character and was she some kind of terrible person or communist or something. And they said, we do have files on her, but we're prohibited from letting you know what's in them. So it does still cast a shadow, even though that they knew that I was innocent of everything. So once I found out about it, my career was over in the U.S. You know, I could not, you know, my records are no longer being played. I was working mostly in Canada and Europe and Australia. So just the idea of being blacklisted had never occurred to me because, you know, especially as a traveling artist, things come and go. They kind of come in waves like, oh, you got a hit in Sweden, but Italy doesn't know about it, right?
Yeah.
You got a hit in Canada, but the U.S. doesn't know about
yeah.
it. So I didn't know. It never occurred to me.
What's it like? Here's another thing I'm curious about. Elvis has hits with your music.
Mm-hmm.
Donovan has a big hit with Universal Soldier.
Everybody thought he wrote it.
He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years.
He's a What's that like for you?
Well, it's still all over the internet. I have a package. I have a package of about 600 letters that Smithsonian Magazine very kindly sent to me when people wrote in to them objecting that they had done a story about Vietnam soldiers writing their comments on tarps and bunks and chests and things. And one, they did a story on this one soldier who had quoted on his, I believe it was on a tarp, He's the one who gives his body as a weapon to a war. And without him, all this killing can't go on, which is my Universal Soldier.
Yeah.
But Smithsonian credited, they didn't know. They said it was an unknown work. So they got over 600 letters. And they apologized to me. They called me up. They apologized. And they said, would you like us to send you the letters? And I said, sure. And, of course, there's all kinds of – there's faxes. There's emails. There's handwritten letters. People who knew that I had written the song. But a lot of people were saying, you're crazy. Donovan wrote that song. This is not an unknown song. It's Donovan's song. And then somebody else credited it to another writer, too. A lot of people will still confront me and say that I didn't write Universal Soldier.
And he knows he shouldn't kill. And he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA.
Did that drive you crazy? That you,
no.
you were getting blacklisted. You couldn't. Your career in the States was over, and here was Elvis and Donovan making a career off your music.
Oh no, we got to separate that in time. I didn't find out I had been blacklisted until the 80s.
Sure.
But I had been blacklisted for many, many years before, but I just didn't know it. I just thought, well, you know, careers come and go.
Yeah.
I was popular in the U.S. for a while, and now I'm not. I felt lucky to be there anyway. I never expected to have a career.
Can we play something else? Let's take a listen to this.
What you doing, Buffy?
I'm feeding the baby. See, he's drinking milk from my breast.
That's a funny way to feed a baby.
Well, lots of mothers feed their babies this way.
Not all mothers, but lots of mothers do.
Oh.
Yeah, he likes it because it's nice and warm and sweet and natural. And it's good for him. And I get to hug him when I do it, see?
Oh. You know, that's nice.
It's my guest, Buffy St. Marie on Sesame Street. That's the episode where you're breastfeeding your son, a first in TV history.
Mm-hmm. Sesame Street were wonderful. They really were. You know, I was on Sesame Street for 5.5 years. They never stereotyped me. You know, it's not always I wasn't the house Indian or something. We did work on a sibling rivalry.
Yeah.
Breastfeeding, multiculturalism, you know, a whole lot of things. And I was nursing my baby. You know, I was on Sesame Street for about a year. Then I found out I was going to have my baby. Took some time off. I had my baby. And then all of a sudden they said, we've never had a family on Sesame Street. And so me and Cody, my son, who was a baby then, and his dad, Sheldon Wolfchild, we were all on Sesame Street for a while. And the day that we did the breastfeeding one, the way that happened was I was breastfeeding him anyway, you know, just off camera and stuff when he needed to eat. he didn't eat sandwiches.
Yeah.
And so I asked them, I said, should we do this? And they said, oh, it's a great idea. So we wrote it up and we did it, you know, in a day or two. And it was just real easy.
Big reaction.
No reaction at the time, but big reaction since.
Oh. So at the time it wasn't...
It wasn't controversial, no.
Oh.
We didn't get any mail on it. No. I've taught, you know, most of the people from Sesame Street that I knew have passed on now. But before they did, I asked them about that. No, they didn't have like a flood of mail about breastfeeding. And what was important about it is I had been blacklisted. I didn't know it, but I had been. So I didn't have a music career at the time I was doing Sesame Street. You know, I was dead in the water. But I went from being dead in the water and blacklisted in the U.S. to reaching 72 countries of the world 3 times a day. How about that, right? They don't put that in the FBI files.
No, you're right.
So it was really a step forward for me. And the fact that I was blacklisted and did not have a different career going on at the time gave me the time to do Sesame Street and to write and do other things.
So I'm struck here now because you go from being blacklisted to this.
The lift is up where we belong.
I saw you play this song at Mariposa, I think, a few years ago.
Oh, yeah? Was it good?
I've never heard you sing it. It was awesome.
Was that okay?
Yeah, it was killer.
It's a real songwriter's version, though.
That's what I was saying to Caitlin earlier. It was just like watching the person who wrote it sing it.
Yeah, it is.
This is, of course, Up Where We Belong, sung by Jennifer Warnes and Joe Cocker, a song you co-wrote for the movie An Officer and a Gentleman that earns you... Buffy St. Marie, your very first Oscar Academy Award, making you the first Indigenous person to ever do so. What does it feel like in that chair when you win an Oscar?
Oh, well, I was having a hard time with my co-writer, Ted Nugent. He was kind of crazy. He was kind of very upset in the car, you know, and he had a thing about flash bulbs because he had optical migraines and things. So I arrived very unhappy and trying not to cry and just sat there through the entire ceremony. And when it was announced that we won, I couldn't believe it. I didn't think we were going to win. I didn't think we were going to win. We were just surprised. And I was just glad that I knew the evening was going to improve because the flashbulbs didn't bother him after we won.
When did it sink in, the meaning of this? When did it sink in that you won an Oscar?
It still hasn't sunk in.
Really?
It's nice. And I, you know, people always bring it up and everything, but it, when I was a little girl, I used to read movie magazines and things, you know. Way back in the 40s, there were, you know, Photoplay and things like that. And just to be a part of Hollywood in the slightest degree was just beyond my wildest dreams. But so it really hasn't sunk in. It's really very wonderful. And the Academy recently, six of us were named pillars of the new Academy Museum.
Yeah.
And I'm one of the pillars.
Oh, congratulations.
So when you go through the Academy Museum, you see that there's a pillar and it has my name carved into it. And it's really nice. Sophia Loren, Hattie McDaniel. Yeah, a bunch of us.
I suppose when you write a song like that, though, I don't want to be gauche here.
Go ahead.
But I bet when you write a song like that, I just know what it's like to tour as an artist. I bet when you write a song like that, your worries go away a little bit.
Your worries go away?
Yeah, because that's a big song. All of a sudden, I don't know if you need to worry so much about, you know, oh my God, how am I going to be able to afford rent and stuff like that?
Oh, you don't make a lot of money. No, the movie company owns the publishing. You don't own the publishing.
For that song?
Yeah.
I figured, oh my God, well, Buffy's straight then. You know, she's on easy street.
Well,
it
helps because you get more famous. And so then when you go out on the road, maybe you can, you know, maybe they'll pay you more because you're better known. But no, I didn't make a lot of money on, I've made it. My money has come from until it's time for you to go.
You're not a dream. You're not an angel. You're a man. I'm not a queen. I'm a woman. Take my hand. We'll make a space in the lives that we'd planned. And here we'll stay until it's time for you to go.
There's another love song.
A beautiful song.
But
too.
A lot of people think of me as a protest writer. But
yeah.
The two songs that have really given me a career in the public have been both love songs. Until it's time for you to go enough where you belong.
Can I? Well, speaking of songs, I was thinking about the podcast you were doing, and we asked Phelan Johnson.
Oh, and she's sweet.
Wonderful. We asked her to. I wanted to play you this. We asked her, you know, to pick out a few favorite Buffy St. Marie songs. This is what she said.
This was impossible. I'd just like to say thanks. I was like, this is so hard. It's so hard. It is so hard. She's, you know, she's 81, 60 years in the industry, like almost 20 albums. Like, how am I supposed to pick five songs?
That's Phelan Johnson, the host of the new CBC podcast, Buffy. Have you learned anything new about yourself doing this podcast, recapping your life and over again to people like me and like Phelan?
No, I don't think I learned from looking back so much, because I already did. I spend a lot of time alone on airplanes, you know, I get a lot of time to think.
Yeah.
But no, I'm always kind of looking forward because I'm hungry to, you know, I like to play the piano. I like to paint. I like to draw. Leave me alone. I'm busy. That's what I'm doing. So that's more important to me. I enjoy what's coming next, and I never know what that's going to be. Because for me, artwork and songs and stuff, it's like dreams. You go to bed at night. You don't know if you're going to dream or what you're going to dream about. That's why I've never been able to write, like, toothpaste commercials and things. When I wrote the title song for the movie Soldier Blue, the director, Ralph Nelson, said, yeah, we want you to write the title song. So I watched the movie and I said, yeah, I can't really commit to being able to write a song for, you know, deadlines and things. I don't know if anything will pop into my head.
Yeah.
So I turned it down twice. And then, sure enough, this song pops into my head. And it did become the theme for Soldier Blue. But, you know, as a writer, I'm just not the kind of writer that can predict anything.
Well, let me ask this then. Maybe this is a good way to close things off. I mean, so let's go back to the children's book. Your second children's book, Top Way and the Magic Hat, came out this month. You dedicate the book to the Paiute and Obe families of Paiute Reserve and Regina, Saskatchewan.
Mm-hmm.
What made you want to dedicate it to them?
Oh, my God, they're my family, and I love them so much. No, we're really close, and I just don't get to spend enough time with them. You know, I've had some family members come to Hawaii and all, but I was just missing people, and that's why, because I love them.
Because I love them is a pretty good answer.
It's a pretty good answer.
I think you've inspired a lot of people. I think you've been through a lot.
Can I say something?
Go ahead.
The book Top Way and the Magic Hat, I begged and pleaded with Greystone Books, Greystone Kids Books, to also do the book in Cree.
Yeah.
And they did. So it's translated by Solomon Ratt, who's a linguist, a Cree linguist teacher at First Nations University. And there's a website called CreeLiteracy.org, which is kind of a residence for Saul. And they've translated My Country, Tis of Thy People, You're Dying into Cree, and the annotated version of My Country, Tis of Thy People, You're Dying, which tells line by line what the song is about. They've also translated Starwalker and several other songs. So CreeLiteracy.org is really a lovely resource.
I mean, in the book itself, I mean, you teach, maybe it's a good way to close things off, you teach people like me how to say miigwech at the end of the... at the end of an interview.
Well, miigwech, you know, actually I have found out through Saul, although Crees and just about everybody use miigwech, actually it's more of an Ojibwe word. And what we would say in Cree would be kinanaskomitin.
Kinanaskomitin.
Kinanaskomitin. Kinanaskomitin. Yeah.
Kinanaskomitin.
That's pretty close.
Kinanaskomitin.
Well, Saul would correct us both.
Well, you know, he can write in a few letters.
Oh, yeah.
Buffy, always a pleasure.
Thanks, Tom. Buffy, really good to see you.
I love seeing you. I mean, let's do this. Let's do this more often.
Okay, twice a week.
Twice a week. You know, I'll get the cot. I don't know, man. It's just not. It's not every day you get to talk to someone like Buffy St. Marie. Like, but I am really lucky in this job. I think I've talked to Buffy. I think it's my fourth time talking to her. It is always fun. It's always joyful. I always learn something about the realities of her world. You know, like Buffy St. Marie is someone who is easy to mythologize, and she has no problem coming in and telling you the realities of what she has gone through in her life and the realities of what her life is like. You know, I am such a massive fan of hers, and if you want to learn more about Buffy St. Marie, I can't recommend enough Phelan Johnson's podcast for CBC. It's made by Phelan Johnson. It's produced by a good friend of mine, Mira Burt-Mintonic, who I think is one of the best podcast producers in the world. They have this new podcast. It's called Buffy. You can find it on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. Caitlin, our Q producer, just said besides me when I said one of the greatest podcast producers in the world. Mira Burt-Mintonic, just one of the greatest podcast producers in the world. Buffy St. Marie has just released her latest children's book. It's called Tepwe and the Magic Hat. I do want to let you know, if you like this podcast, tell a friend about it, subscribe, share, I don't know, buy a Facebook ad. I don't know if you're allowed to do that, but if you are, come on, help me out. We'll see you soon. Later on.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.